This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
So thanks, George. Thank you, Joe, for joining us on Jodcast. Been in this segment before, that's right?
Absolutely, a few times, yeah.
Awesome. Could you remind us what you do here?
So I'm a cosmologist. I'm a postdoctoral researcher, so I'm after PhD and before permanent job status. And I study lensing, which is the bending of light by matter, particularly the weak form of lensing. So that's looking at how dark matter in the universe, as it's spread across the universe in small amounts, so not big, collapsed, massive objects, but the kind of diffuse background field, how that distorts the light from distant galaxies. And we can use that pattern to give us a map of the matter and gravity distribution in the universe.
Awesome. And thank you for being here to answer some of our listeners' questions.
Thank you for having me.
So our first question comes in from Ollie Sargent, and he says, we're told the age of the universe is about 13.5 billion years old. We're also told that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. Does this mean that the Earth has been in existence for a third of the universe's entire life? When you take into account the average life expectancy of a star the size of our Sun, about 10 billion years, it seems like the universe can't possibly be 13.5 billion years old. It's said that the Earth's heavy elements came from a star before the Sun, but if this had an average life expectancy of 10 billion years as well, then you have to consider that the universe is at least 14.5 billion years old. And that's not even taking into account how long it took that star to form in the first place, and how long it took for our solar system to form. So how do we reconcile the age of the solar system with the age of the universe?
So Ollie's absolutely right. This is a genuine puzzle. And he's absolutely right as well. There wasn't time for another sun like ours to have formed, lived and died before our sun came into being. There wasn't time to do that. But the keywords there were like our sun. So one of the most important factors that determine how a star evolves, how it lives, how it dies, is what astronomers call its metallicity. So that's the amount of the heavier elements that are in it. And that's ultimately because the amount of metal that's in a plasma changes how it emits heat. So if material that the star is made of emits heat differently, that will change how it evolves, how it lives, how it dies. Now the upshot of that is that stars with very low amounts of metal, like the very first ones, the first generation of stars, which we call population 3 stars, those should have been much more massive than our current stars, and they should have had very, very short lives. So if the plasma emits very, very slowly, it ends up having a very short life, the star. So those stars possibly lived for as little as a few million years, not the billions of years that our sun's going to live for. There was time for a generation of these primordial stars to live before our sun, and to go supernova, and to spread the heavy elements across the galaxy, so that when our sun formed a billion years or two later, then there was enough heavy elements for the observations that we see in the sun.
Amazing. So the first stars created the metals that help form our planet.
Exactly.
But they also help our sun to last longer, which gives us some more time to enjoy it.
It does, true. Yeah.
Thank you. And our second question is from John Brooks. So he asks, physicists estimate that the universe contains roughly 4% ordinary matter, with the rest being dark matter and dark energy. How can they possibly measure every single particle of matter when most of it cannot be seen due to distances and temperatures? Looking at one section of the universe and saying everything else is the same, isn't that a flawed assumption? Only recently we've been shown that matter stretches between galaxies, so what else is out there that we can't see at the moment? It seems to me that scientists use too much poetic licensing to try and make an unfounded assumption fact. So Joe, how do we look at one area of the universe and infer the details about the rest?
So this is a very popular question, especially from other scientists towards cosmologists and other astronomers towards cosmologists as well. So first of all, we don't actually measure every particle in the universe. That's not how we try and do these things. We don't do it by kind of mass observation of everything. We do this statistically and by looking at the indirect effect of things. That upsets some people, the fact we only have indirect evidence of dark matter. But indirect evidence is the norm in probably most of astronomy and perhaps most of science. If you don't like indirect evidence, there's no evidence of black holes or evolution or indeed wind. So really you have to accept that sometimes we can't see things directly and we have to see them indirectly. And actually there's probably more evidence for dark matter than there is for black holes. So that's an interesting comparison. So the first evidence for dark matter, which is indirect, comes from gravity. And in fact all the evidence is from gravity. But it's a very, very simple chain of reasoning that takes us to dark matter in the first place. Basically, we can see objects being pulled by gravity, so there must be some kind of matter there pulling them. But there's nothing bright there, or we would see it, so it must be dark. And so that's all that dark matter has to be in the first analysis. It's just matter that is dark. So that's not particularly weird. Lots of matter is dark. Most matter in the universe does not emit light, or not much light. So that's not too surprising. That's not too weird. But the next part of the story does get a little bit more exotic and a little bit more strange, and that's about the microwave background, the distant light from the very early universe. We can see by looking at the microwave background that the universe is the same everywhere. That was one thing that John asked about. John asked, how do we know the universe is the same everywhere? And though in cosmology we call that homogeneity, or like the word homogeneous. And actually that's not an assumption. That's actually a very well-founded observation. The snapshot of the microwave background is a snapshot of the early universe before it grew to its current size, and we can see in that early snapshot that things are basically the same everywhere. Not identical, so we're not saying that the universe is exactly the same everywhere. You know, this galaxy's here, this galaxy's there. What we're saying is it's statistically identical, so things are roughly the same patterns, or the same kinds of patterns, in one direction as in another direction. Now, what the microwave background also tells us is about how structure formed. So how the very tiny fluctuations we see in the microwave background grew into the galaxies and the clusters of galaxies that we see today. And there really is no way to make that work. There's no way to track that evolution, because we can watch the evolution happen through cosmic time, because when we look out in space, we also look back in time. There's no way to make that evolution make sense without some kind of dark matter. So the question then becomes, how weird is this? And perhaps there is another explanation, and so that's a very reasonable question. It's not too weird to have new particles. Particle physicists know about huge numbers of particles, all kinds of different exotic new particles and made-in particle accelerators over the last 50, 100 years. So it's not too crazy to postulate a new one. It's not, you know, it's not unheard of for a new kind of particle to be discovered. So it's not a way-out thing to be doing. The other question is whether there is another explanation for this that's simpler or more direct than dark matter. The analogy that I've seen made very nicely is about planets in the solar system. So we've looked at two planets in our solar system where their motion was not as we expected. One was Neptune and one was Mercury. In the case of Neptune, its motion was being influenced by the dwarf planet Pluto. So we couldn't see Pluto originally, but we did know it was predicted it should exist because we saw Neptune's orbit moving around. And that was an example of dark matter. We couldn't see Pluto because it was too dark at the time, but we could infer its motion from something else. So that's a kind of dark matter scenario. But there is a modified gravity scenario as well, which is the orbit of Mercury. Mercury's orbit was precessing, that means the direction it takes, so the orbits are ellipses, and the sort of orientation of that ellipse was slowly moving round and round. For a while, people thought there was a planet Vulcan. People imagined a planet Vulcan inside the orbit of Mercury to affect its motion. That turned out to be wrong. The actual explanation for Mercury's orbit was general relativity, so Einstein's modification to the laws of gravity to make it consistent with those observations and more generally useful. So those are both reasonable explanations to start with. But I think at this point we've almost come to the end of the modified gravity explanation for dark matter. I have done work on this myself. I'm not an disinterested person, but I've done work trying to find a good theory of dark matter that explains the structure in the universe, and it's really very, very hard to do, because dark matter is simple in a number of interesting ways which are really quite subtle. So it looks like there isn't another explanation that works better than dark matter for a whole host of indirect observations. The last thing that John said was, is this kind of poetic license, and astronomers are occasionally too poetical, but normally after the fact. We normally find out the observations and then write the poetry afterwards rather than doing it the other way around. And actually, in the case of dark matter, the evidence for dark matter, the evidence is very, very strong, and it's not kind of poem length, it is telephone directory length or stacks of telephone directory length.
Fantastic. And it's funny that you mentioned Mercury. Our last question again comes from John, and it's a bit closer to home, and it's about Mercury. He asks, if you could stand on the surface of Mercury and look up at the sun, how big would it be in the sky compared to what we see on Earth?
Mercury is about 0.38 AU from the Sun, which means it's about 40% of the distance that the Earth is from the Sun, which correspondingly means the Earth is about 2.6 times further away from the Sun than Mercury. Which means if you were on Mercury looking up at the sky, the sort of size of the Sun, how far it is across, would be about 2.6 times bigger. So the Sun takes about half a degree at the Earth. If you hold your hands out, your fingers are half a degree apart if you're pointing at the Sun. And so that would be about 1.3 degrees across if you were on the surface of Mercury. Now, in area, which is what you actually perceive when you look at how big something is, means the square of 2.6 is what happens, is what you actually see. So if you were looking, if you were sitting on Mercury, the Sun would look about 7 times bigger than it does on Earth, and correspondingly about 7 times brighter, or probably more, because Earth has an atmosphere and Mercury doesn't.
Wow, fantastic. Thanks again, Joe.
Thanks a lot.